Breakfast at Sally's by Richard Lemieux. Chapter 21. The Hilton. C and I parked the van in the parking lot of the mental institution because the trail through the woods to the kids' camp was just up the road. We walked a couple hundred yards along Amira Drive until C located the entrance to the path. Willow bounded along in front of us. Finally, I asked, "Are you sure this is the way?"
"This is the trail, all right," replied C. "They just don't want to be found. It's just around the corner."
Moments later, I could see big blue tarps through the trees.
"Hello, anybody home? It's C," he called out.
Four boys and a girl were sitting on wooden crates around a small campfire. They waved and smiled as we emerged from the woods into the clearing.
"Hey, Jason, I see you guys are still here," said C as we got closer.
"They haven't chased us out yet," Jason said. He was maybe 16 or 17, wearing a weather-stained Seattle Mariners baseball cap.
"Where's Adam?" asked C.
"I'm in here, C,"
a muffled voice called out from inside a tent-like structure made from two or three large tarps tied to the trees with frayed rope.
"So you're home,"
C responded, stepping toward the makeshift door cut into one of the tarps. Willow and I followed along. Adam was heating water in a pan on a rusty, dented Coleman stove as we entered. He turned and bowed at the waist.
"Welcome to my humble abode," he said.
C introduced us.
"This is Richard and his dog, Willow."
"Yes, I've seen you around. Nice to meet you. I'm just making some tree bark tea. Would you like some?" He turned back to the near boiling pan of water.
"Yes, thank you," C responded. "Richard, how about you?"
"Sure," I said.
Willow had wandered off to the side of the tent and was sniffing at several trash bags. I called her back.
"It's okay," said Adam. "She smells the food in those bags. I've got cereal, eggs, bananas, and other stuff like that in them."
C sat down on one of the large upside-down buckets. He pulled his pipe from his pocket, placed it in his mouth, and blew the sediment from it. Reaching into his pocket from the plastic pouch of smoke, he began filling his bowl.
"What's the latest?" he asked Adam.
"Well, we're still about 10, was the reply. "I haven't seen Justin or Heather for a couple of days, but their stuff is still here."
He paused as he prepared our tea. "I hope they haven't fallen into harm's way. The police haven't roused us out for about a month and a half, so that's about due. We just take it one day at a time." He handed a steaming cup to C, brought me a cup, and returned the stove to pour his own. When he finally settled down on a seat, C handed him a bag of smoke.
"Thanks, C," said Adam, taking his pipe from his shirt pocket and reaching out to accept the gift.
As the two began their smoking ritual, I used the moment to take a look around. The sun shining through the tarps gave the room a light blue hue. Adam had stored his clothing in some clear plastic trash bags in one corner of the tent. A loud female voice broke the silence.
"Bob, report to Lawn and Garden. Bob, Lawn and Garden."
It was the loudspeaker system at the large Fred Meyer complex at the edge of the woods.
"We hear it every 15 or 20 minutes," Adam said. "Probably somebody wanting to buy a gallon or two of weed be gone. Jesus, no wonder all the fish are dying in Hood Canal and Puget Sound with all the weed killer people are using."
He took a hit off his pipe.
"They are probably going to spend $1 million on a study to find out what is killing the fish when all they really have to do is go down the street to Home Depot and ask how much weed killer they sold last year."
The kids were laughing about something outside.
"I did not," I heard Jason say. "Yes, you did,"
a girl's voice countered.
"You said, run, baby rabbit, run before they get you. Run, bunny, run, run, run in your sleep. Everybody heard you, didn't they, Mike?"
Mike confirmed that Maria was right. Adam, C, and I laughed.
"This is excellent, Adam, as usual," C said, holding up his cup of tea. "I really enjoyed sharing the stuff you gave me last time I was out here."
Well, thanks. It's just something I experimented with, Adam replied, cupping both hands around his mug. I heard somebody bought this land, he continued. Someone read in the paper that they're going to level it and put in a go-kart track, a baseball batting cage, and a miniature golf course.
I haven't heard that, C said, but I wouldn't be surprised.
It's supposed to be all lighted for night use, Adam said. Our conversation was interrupted by a youthful voice calling out, Hey, Adam! A young man stuck his head in the tent. C, Richard, this is Gentry, Adam made the introductions. It's my turn to go get water, Gentry said, holding up a couple of empty plastic milk cartons. Maria's coming. We're going to the 76 station because they let us fill these up last time. We'll be back. Okay, Adam replied. These young people were living like the Suquamish Indian tribe had lived here in the woods 200 years before, I thought to myself as Gentry closed the makeshift door and left. The tribe now had the biggest gambling casino in the Seattle area, providing their patrons with free ferry rides and limousine service 18 hours a day, 360 days a year. Adam's tribe had dug a latrine and went plowing through dumpsters at night for tarps, chairs, and anything that could be used in camp. There was water to carry, food to share, and chores to be done, and each took a turn guarding the village. But the biggest shift over the past 200 years was that this refuge in the woods was now surrounded by Burger King, Napa Auto Parts, the Dollar Store, PetSmart, Outback Steakhouse, and Bob and his weed killer. Adam appeared to be the oldest and the leader of his tribe.
How many other camps are there now? C asked Adam.
Oh, I'm not sure. 5 or 6, I think, he replied. Mars? You know Mars? C nodded. He used to be here and he moved into the woods behind the dealerships on Auto Center Way. I think they have about 18 people living there. Howie has a camp of about 10 that I know of behind the fairgrounds. But man, he's paranoid. He gets high on coke and wants to move the camp in the middle of the night. I try to stay away from him. This is the Hilton. Howie's camp is a Motel 6. Bob! Attention, Bob! Bob to automotive! Bob to automotive! The perky voice on the Fred Meyer loudspeakers intruded upon the village again. They've chased Howie out more than once. The police did a sweep back in there a couple of months ago and took their tarps, chairs, blankets, food, and everything during the day. They were getting ready for a monster truck show and a pro wrestling event at the fairgrounds and wanted to make sure the homeless weren't around. Adam's smoke was now gone, and C passed his young friend the bag, saying, "This is pretty mild stuff." The irritating sound of a car alarm going off in the distance filled the silence as the two focused on their pipes again, blowing away the residue, packing the weed just right, then lighting and inhaling. "It's good," Adam said of C's stash. "You don't smoke?" he asked me. "No," I said. Adam stood up from his white plastic bucket and stretched. He was tall, with long, thin brown hair and a bristly beard. He walked over by the Coleman stove again and pushed the button on a small plastic radio. Strains of classical music filled the tent.
"Oh, great, classical," said C.
"You like classical, too?" Adam asked.
"Love it," was C's reply.
I had seen and heard a lot of strange things while riding around with C, but a homeless boy whose taste in music runs to the Baroque? I had to admit that this was a bit surprising. Hard rock or country would have seemed much more likely, but then I had never seen a young man functioning as the mayor of a tent city for misfit teens, so how could I guess what his musical taste would be? Far be it from me to judge any of this experience. The world obviously had many surprises in store for me yet. I usually save the battery so I can play the radio at night, Adam was saying, but today is special because you and Richard are here. He explained how he'd found the radio in the dumpster behind Fred Meyer and hated leaving it when he went into town. The police might do a sweep and take everything. He'd lost everything last time, all his books and his clothes. He'd heard them coming and hidden in the bushes. There were 2 cops and 4 guys they hired for $6 an hour from AmeriCorps. he recognized three of them from Sally's. It only took them about an hour to toss everything into big black plastic bags and cart it off. Beep, 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 beep. The sound of a car alarm once again invaded the woods. Bob, go to Lawn and Garden. Bob, to Lawn and Garden, followed soon after. Adam walked over to the radio and turned the volume up a notch. Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. I like this, he said, attempting to ignore the sounds of what some call civilization. He poured himself another cup of tea and looked at C. Would you like another cup?
Sure, said C, handing his cup to Adam.
Richard? Adam was holding out the scorched and battered pan. No, I'm okay for now, I answered.
You seen anything of Mojo?
C asked Adam. Not for a couple of months, I guess. As Adam and C resumed their conversation, my mind wandered off, as it often does. I thought about my life when I was Adam's age. I had a job making $1.25 an hour as a printer's devil at the Urbana Citizen newspaper in Ohio. On a day like today, my main concern, something that had consumed my very being for the entire week, was whether my girlfriend, Bonnie, was going to put out when we went to the New Moon drive-in movie that night. Bonnie was 16, and she was my dream. She had long blonde hair and was a member of the flag corps of the high school marching band. She looked stunning in her short black skirt and long red boots as she flipped the flag to the music, then held the pole straight out and marched forward while the band played the high school fight song. I had the entire night planned out in my mind. I would pick up Bonnie at 6. She would hop into my 1952 dark blue Ford Fairlane, which I had spit-polished twice in the previous 4 days. She would sit close like she always did, and we would go for burgers and fries. We would talk about the silliest things. She thought Cookie Burns was a dream, and the Beatles were her favorite band. I never disagreed. I had given her my class ring from high school. We would listen to the radio on the way to the New Moon, Chubby Checker singing The Twist, Chuck Berry's Maybelline, The Coasters' Yakety Yak, Jimmy Rogers' Kisses Sweeter Than Wine, and we would turn the volume up all the way for the Big Bopper and Chantilly Lace. I would always sing along with the bopper, lowering my voice. Chantilly Lace with a pretty face and a ponytail hanging down that wiggle in the walk. And Bonnie would giggle and put her hand on my leg. It was Hero Night at the New Moon, a doubleheader of Zorro and Tarzan. But we didn't come to the New Moon for the cinematic experience. After we struggled to attach the big aluminum speaker to the Fairlane window, Bonnie moved closer to me, and I wrapped my arm around her shoulder. She was a siren. Some gene had been passed from Jezebel herself directly down to Bonnie. She let me know just what she wanted as I looked into her eyes, pressed forward to kiss her precious lips, and reached inside her white cotton bra for the buried treasure. Her breathing would quicken, and a sultry, sensuous moan came from deep within as she reached out to touch me.
"Hey, Richard, Richard, what are you smiling about?"
C's raspy voice interrupted my trip back to the New Moon. I wanted to reach out and wipe the fog off the car windows. "Oh, I was just thinking of a pleasant place I was once," I said, somewhat sheepishly. "I think it was 1963 or 64.
"Geez, I wasn't born yet," C kidded.
"It was my age of innocence," I said. "There were no McDonald's, no Walmarts. The television stations put test patterns on at midnight. No radio talk shows, no CNN, no Fox News." "Helene is coming," Gentry interrupted me by pushing the plastic tent flap open. "Great," said Adam, hurrying out. C was right behind him. I lingered in Adam's tent for a few moments, looking at the books lying beside his sleeping bag and his few other possessions. I didn't know how he got here, or if he would ever escape this life, but I admired him for being able to smile. I knew I couldn't have survived in the woods like this when I was 17. I didn't remember children living like this at all back then. Had I just been oblivious, or had the world changed? And now, while Adam, Maria, and the others were hoping just to be left alone in this small patch of tranquility, other children their age had been taught to race past this type of haven to get their first job at McDonald's, and then on to another job at Target, and another at one of the mall stores. Soon, of course, they'd race to the bank to cash their checks and make their car and insurance payments. To what end was all this leading? I headed out to join the others. As I ducked through the door and let the flap fall behind me, I saw three women enter the camp carrying cardboard boxes. The women appeared to be in their 40s or 50s. "Are you guys hungry?" asked Helene, a short woman who appeared happy to be setting down her large box. "Whoa, that was heavy!" The other two, also struggling, set their heavy burdens on the ground. "See, and Richard, I would like you to meet Helene," Adam said, stretching his long arm around the lady, who then reached out and gave him a hug. "And this is Charlotte and Jean." Helene went over to the other women and held each hand as she introduced her compatriots. "We have brought you some lunch. We'd better eat it while it's hot," she said, ripping open the top of the box and lifting out plastic tubs of food. The ladies had thought of everything. Paper bowls, plastic forks and spoons, salt and pepper all appeared as they set up lunch. "Please join us," Helene said, looking at C and me. "We have plenty."
"I can't say no to a lady who says please," C said.
Both he and I both accepted a bowl of homemade stew. "We have rolls and butter in this box," Helene continued. "Some Coke and apple juice in the other. And I've got Hershey bars, graham crackers, and marshmallows for s'mores in my backpack," Jean chimed in. C sampled the stew and looked at me. I tasted a spoonful and took a bite out of the homemade buttered roll. "A 5-star picnic," I concluded.
"Most definitely," C concurred.
Helene watched Maria wipe her mouth on her shirt sleeves and got up and pulled a bunch of napkins out of the box. "Here, Maria," she said, handing the girl a napkin. "I forgot to pass these out."
"Okay, Mom,
we'll use our napkins," Adam said, laughing. "Helene has been like a mom to us," he continued, looking at C. "She brings us lunch and dinner a couple of times a week and even does our laundry sometimes."
"Goodness!"
C's eyes widened in amazement.
"Laundry? That's kind of you. All this is so, well, very kind of you. Why?"
"This is just a small payback for what someone I never met did for my son," Helene answered. "He ran away when he was 15 and went to California."
She described how he'd lived in the woods around Mount Shasta. A woman of about 60 came upon his camp one day while hiking. She befriended him, and for 3 years, 4 times a week, she hiked the 4 miles to his campsite with food, clean socks, and books. She even went there on Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's Day.
"She saved his life," said Helene.
Then one day, she convinced him it was time to see his mother. She drove him all the way home, dropped him off at the curb, and drove away. Helene had never gotten to say thank you. Her voice began to tremble. Jean, sensing the need to lighten the moment, said,
"Let's have some s'mores."
She broke out the crackers, chocolate bars, and marshmallows, and C whipped out his always sharp knife to fashion some marshmallow sticks. For a couple of hours, we sat around the smoldering campfire and talked. Helene seemed a little uncomfortable when Adam and C dug their marijuana pipes out of their pockets for another smoke. But Jean asked,
"Do you mind if I have a hit? It's been, well, maybe 30 years.
Adam, somewhat shocked and smiled, said, "Whoa," and then passed his pipe politely over to her.
She took a drag and held it up for a moment before exhaling. "The last time I did that, I was a junior at Kent State," she said. "I was there when Governor James Rhodes sent in the National Guard."
"Kent State? Where is that?" Jason asked.
"It's in Ohio," Jean responded. "I was there when they shot the students."
"Shot the students?" Maria asked.
"Yes, the National Guard shot some students during a demonstration."
"You know, Maria, 4 dead in Ohio," Adam interjected.
"Oh, yeah, I know that song," Jason said. "But I didn't know anybody really got shot. I thought it was just a song."
"They were protesting the war, right?" asked Adam.
"Well, that was part of it," Jean answered.
"They were protesting the war, the government, the American invasion of Cambodia. Two of the students who were killed were just walking to class."
Charlotte, who had been so quiet, was intrigued.
"Did you wear tie-dye?"
she asked Jean.
"I sure did," Jean laughed. "Instead of this old navy sweatshirt, Wrangler jeans, and New Balance tennis shoes, I used to wear tie-dyed t-shirts, multicolored pleated dresses, and sandals. I wore my hair long, not short like this," she said, brushing her hand across the side of her hair.
"Were you an anti-war demonstrator?" Charlotte asked.
"Yes, I was," she responded. "I never knew that about you," Charlotte said to Jean, "and I've known you for 15 or 16 years. I grew up in Pittsburgh, and when it came time to go to college, I couldn't get into the Eastern schools," Jean said. "But I got into Kent State, and I loved it. Kids from New York, Boston, Philadelphia, all went there because it was cheaper than the schools in the East, only $125 per quarter. We were alive with ideas, art, and music. We were going to save the world."
Willow's nose had led her to the s'mores Jean was preparing, and the little dog placed her front paws on the lady's knee as if to say, "How about me?" She gave Jean that irresistible look.
"Well, aren't you just a cutesy little creature?" said Jean.
"That's Willow. I should have introduced her earlier." Jean broke off a piece of cracker and held it out to Willow, who took it gently from her hand and began to crunch on it. It didn't take her long to finish off that morsel, and she hopped up again on Jean's leg and cocked her head.
"You want more?"
Jean asked, as she was already breaking off another piece of cracker.
"Richard calls her the Wonder Dog," said C, and we all laughed.
"Because she does tricks?" Helene asked.
"Sometimes she will sit her roll over when I asked," I replied, "and sometimes she just looks at me as if to say, 'Why don't you sit a roll over this time?' That's why she's the Wonder Dog."
Helene took the last bite of her s'more and slowly stood up.
"Well, I'm sorry to say, but I think we better get going," she said. "Do you have any laundry for us?"
The kids all went to their tents to gather up their dirty clothes and quickly returned with about 6 bags worth.
"Whoa!"
Helene exclaimed, surveying the assortment of bags.
"I guess we'll be busy tonight."
"We'll help you carry them out," C offered the ladies. "It's about time for us to go, too."
Helene went to Adam and gave him a big hug.
"If any of you need us, don't hesitate," she said.
Jean put her arm around Maria, and Charlotte put her hand on Jason's back.
"You have my number. Just get to a phone and call."
After heartfelt goodbyes, the ladies, C, and I picked up the laundry bags and empty boxes and headed down the trail toward the road. The women were silent as we trudged along with the heavy sacks. When we got to their car, they thanked C and me for our assistance. Helene gave C an embrace. With tears beginning to fill her eyes, she asked,
"Are they going to be okay?"
"Yes, thanks to you, I think they are,"
C responded. The ladies all got into their car, and we waved as they all pulled away.
"Those women have spunk," said C, watching them drive off.
After a moment, we headed for the van.
"Hey, you want to go over and see Andy's new digs?" C asked.
That's tonight's episode. At this point, we must break off our reading. You've been hearing Breakfast at Sally's by Richard Lemieux. Copyright 2009. It is read with the permission of Skyhorse Publishing of New York. Join us next time on The Bookshelf for Breakfast at Sally's. The Bookshelf is produced and edited by Vern Windham. I'm Jeff Hazen.